Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Well, Bristol's first podcast Dialect is back at our new Friday afternoon 2pm slot. This week, we're joined by disabled campaigner Jason Yannakopoulos. Also, Scottish crofting. What is it and why of interest to those of us south of the border, particularly with a financial crisis in full swing? Plus, our weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 every Friday afternoon. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square, and Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number's 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. But we start this week with Andy Whiteman. He wrote a book called The Poor Had No Lawyers, and I'm joined now by Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, to discuss this. Martin, why would we be looking at Scottish land rights and what's been going on in Scotland? Because one of the things that certainly seems to me pretty clear is that there is this whole thing called crofting in Scotland, where people have got fantastic security of tenure. They're not actually biting their nails anything like the way that people paying mortgages and rent are here in Britain. The crofters aren't, anyway.
No, but it was won on the back of a struggle at the end of the 19th century. Basically, what's left of crofting is the people who were driven off the glens. Many of them had to leave Scotland. They ended up on the what they call the Macha, which is the coastal region of Scotland, and they had a huge struggle with the landowners to get crofting rights. So crofters have their own. There was Acts of Parliament passed at the time as a result of quite strenuous resistance, which have led to particular rights for tenant farmers, i.e. crofters, in that part of the world, which are unique and are not copied anywhere else.
And it's a type of privatisation we don't really think much about nowadays. I mean, we're hearing about all sorts of things being privatised, obviously things like the NHS being part privatised and other types of things like that, and also the railways, water, that kind of thing. But for many of us, it's a bit of news, isn't it, that actually the land was privatised.
Well, yes, but I mean, what's happened with the crofters is that they've got particular rights to tenancy. So they don't own the land, but they cannot be removed from it, and tenancies can be inherited and so on and so forth. So in actual fact, most property rights are fungible, that is to say they're negotiable. When you say you own land, basically you own the freehold of the land, which actually in strict legal parlance means that it still belongs to the Crown. So in actual fact, when you say I own this toothbrush, that's fairly clear what you're saying. When you say I own this land, there's usually some negotiation involved with it.
OK, so let's get on and have a listen to Andy Whiteman then, who I spoke to from Edinburgh about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
My name's Andy Whiteman. I live in Edinburgh, and for 20 years I've been working on issues to do with land ownership, land rights, land tenure, mainly in Scotland. Beginning in the 90s with documenting who owns Scotland, and more recently trying to answer the interesting question about what happened to the approximately half of Scotland which was in common ownership of one form or another at the end of the 16th century and which has mostly disappeared ever since. I went to university to study forestry in Aberdeen in the 80s, and it was a time when celebrities, rich people like Terry Wogan and Shirley Porter were getting big tax breaks to plant conifer forests in the far north of Scotland, in Caithness. And the chief executive of the company who was responsible for that, Fountain Forestry, they were called, came to university, gave a lecture, and I asked afterwards in the questions session why the government, this was the Thatcher government in the 80s, was giving large tax concessions to very rich people in London to plant trees 600 miles away in Caithness. Why not simply give the money directly to the crofters and the farmers and the landowners in Caithness? And I can't remember what the answer was, but afterwards I do remember being hauled aside by my professor and advised that such questions were politically provocative and I should be perhaps a little bit more careful in the questions I asked, which kind of shocked and surprised me because this was a university where, you know, nothing is meant to be off limits. But it got me inquiring into why that was such an uncomfortable question, and it was an uncomfortable question because it started questioning the kind of fundamentals about land and power and money in a way that wasn't deemed to be welcome. So since then, I've always been interested in getting to the roots of questions of land and money and power, usually by asking, you know, well, who owns it? Which is a great intro to many situations. So when I documented land ownership in the 90s, it confirmed what previous people had shown, John McEwen most particularly in the 1970s, that a very, very small number of people own most of the land. It's a very concentrated pattern of private land ownership. And I'm keen to reform that, to change it, to give more opportunities for individuals and communities to own land. But I'm also keen to get to the roots of why that situation has emerged, and that is due to things like our laws of inheritance, etc., which we need to change.
Now, I mean, all you need to do really, I suppose, is to look at the British Parliament in England, and there you see a House of Lords, which at least traditionally, anyway, was for sort of feudal lords, the people that own the land, and then the Commons, which is largely represents the sort of merchant class, the people that own the money. Is there any real difference, do you think, between the concentration of power in the hands of those who own the land, the concentration of power in those that control the money?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, no, I don't think there is, because I think it is all to do with elites. I'm doing a show in the Edinburgh Festival called The Scottish Six, which is exploring questions of elite capture of money, of power, governance, and of land. So, yeah, I think they are, in fact, intimately related, because, of course, the property qualification was an important qualification for standing voting up until the Reform Acts of the 19th century. And even into this century, you know, we had a law in Scotland, the law of entail, which was passed in the 17th century by the old Scots Parliament before the Union, which basically protected landowners' assets, their land, against the action of creditors. So if you went bankrupt and you were the Earl of Hopetoun in 1820 and your estate was entailed, that meant your creditors couldn't get hold of your land. I mean, that law was only ended, it wasn't even ended in 1914, it was merely that beyond that you couldn't entail any new estates. We only abolished feudal tenure in 2004. We only ended primogeniture, the right for the eldest male to inherit, in 1964. So yeah, I mean, we're living within a system of power and elites which has been under the control of these elites for a very, very long time. And it's in marked contrast to the kind of revolutions that swept continental Europe, where typically by the mid-19th century, certainly, they'd got rid of feudalism, they'd got rid of primogeniture, the land was in the hands of many, many more people. Big cooperatives emerged in continental Europe and France, like Brittany Ferries, Crédit Agricole, etc. These were in response to the fact that many, many small peasants owned land, and they had to cooperate in order to be economically efficient, which is what they did. But precisely the opposite happened here. We had a growing concentration of land ownership, in fact, over much of the 18th and 19th century. In the early part of the 20th century, it relaxed a little bit. But in the last 10, 20 years, in fact, it's been reconcentrating again, because land is, you know, a last refuge for capital. And in an unregulated market such as we have in Britain and in Scotland, it means we now have Russian oligarchs, Middle Eastern sheikhs, etc., buying up not just rural land, but urban property too.
Andy Whiteman there in his book, The Poor Had No Lawyers. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, he's saying some fascinating things there. I mean, what about this law of entail, which meant that you could, basically a landowner, even though he owned the land, even if he was massively in debt, no one could get their hands on that land.
Yeah, well, entail implies that it's going to go to his successor, whoever that might be, presumably his son if we're working with primogeniture. I think what's interesting, what's being said there, is the different development trajectories of countries like Britain and Scotland and other continental countries. We presume that it's normal for peasantries to disappear as you progress, but in actual fact, a large proportion of the world's population remain peasants, and you saw developments in continental Europe in which peasant agriculture was not so completely wiped out as it was in the British Isles.
So how was it so completely wiped out, as you say?
Well, I mean, in Britain, industrialised first, and the precursor to industrialisation was enclosure of the land in England and the Highland clearances in Scotland. And of course that creates a kind of landless proletariat, which is then either absorbed into factories in Glasgow or Liverpool or sent abroad to Canada or Australia. In other parts of the continental Europe, particularly France, the peasants, because it gained a degree of political power through the French Revolution, and therefore the development trajectory was different. Also different again in the Southeast Asia, where small farmers retained some kind of rights in Japan, and they were not removed from the land, and remain a kind of serious lobby inside Japanese politics.
And he's also mentioned the Reform Acts there, but I got this is in the 1800s, but I got the idea that, well, these Reform Acts happened, but it was almost as if the people who were given the power to vote actually didn't have a lot of power by that time.
Well, yes, I mean, let's face it, the ruling class have always ruled Britain. They still do, and they always did. And there are some modifications to that power, but not as much as people think.
So were you saying that democracy is just really some kind of an illusion? Because a ruling class, yes, surely that they are, they certainly could be landowners or they could be very rich, but ultimately it's the people that decide who is going to represent them, who's going to be there in Parliament for them.
Only in the textbooks. If you actually look at the history books, it's quite the opposite. I mean, what was a very striking feature of the way Britain developed was that as merchants became wealthy, they would marry into aristocratic families. So the classic thing would be a merchant's daughter marrying a penniless aristocrat, and the two fortunes then become linked. And there's a whole theory of what they call gentlemanly capitalism in Britain, whereby as soon as people become wealthy, they affect the manners of aristocrats, and they're not interested in trade anymore. Unlike, for example, in Germany, where the solid burghers and bourgeois were the backbone of the society. I mean, you can read in the literature all sorts of theories that are spun around these differences between the development paths that countries get onto. But of course, you can only develop your country once. And it's got a certain implications for what kind of society comes out at the end of it. And of course, basically ruling classes tend to continue with their power. They have all the resources. They tend to make sure that they continue having them.
Enclosure, privatisation of land. Is it fair to say that that's one of the reasons that there were all these people that have been evicted from the land by these wealthy landowners who were there ready to go and work in the factories? And that's one of the reasons why the Industrial Revolution happened here.
Yeah, and don't forget that what you're doing is you're producing as much food as possible, so that people, basically Britain has not been self-sufficient in food for a long time. And the purpose of that is that you get low wages and food is cheap, and you don't worry about the food production system. You're more concerned with industrial production.
So why is food
cheap?
Because we can't produce enough. Surely that would be more expensive.
Well, no, because what you do is you get New Zealand to provide you with all of your lamb steaks. I mean, when the Dunedin docks in London providing lamb, frozen lamb, cheaper than could be provided from Wales, agriculture was finished in Britain as a free market concept. And we've basically kept it going, basically in order to keep the wealthy classes in the style to which they've become accustomed. Most EU subsidies go to a small number of farmers based in the southeast of England.
And Andy talked there also about common ownership. So how has the land gone from this kind of common ownership to being controlled and owned by a tiny number of elite landowners in Scotland?
Well, in Scotland, what you used to have is clan ownership. So the MacDonalds or whatever would own a certain number of glens, and in theory that belonged to the whole clan. But what happened during the Highland clearances is that the leaders of those clans, the chief of MacDonalds or whatever it was,
This was the late 1800s.
Yeah,
roughly,
but yeah. They developed the habits of English gentlemen, which meant that the land belonged to them. Now, that was actually resisted by their tenants, but not very strongly. It was resisted much more strongly in Ireland, where you will find that valleys are still full of small farmers. They're not full of small farmers in Scotland. They're all concentrated on the coast, which is where the Crofting Rebellion took place in the 1880s and sort of basically drew a line in the sand on that process.
OK, well, let's go back now to Andy Whiteman and my discussion with him a couple of weeks ago. It may well be that we get a little bit more distribution of land ownership, but the fact of the matter is that the money is being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, and in fact, sometimes not even the hands of individuals, into sort of faceless corporations.
Yeah, I mean, money is an important entry into all of this. I mean, I believe that we need to return to a much more widespread use of land taxes. So I'm a proponent of land value taxation. I mean, that in itself would help to reduce the concentration of ownership profoundly. It would release land that's currently being underutilized for more profitable use by those who could make better use of it. And historically, of course, most of the taxation revenue of the state was from land taxes. And one of the stories of land is how land has reduced in its proportion of taxes. So we've increased, you know, business taxes, corporation tax, income tax, value-added sales taxes, etc., at the expense of land tax. So those that own land are now very, very little taxed at all. In fact, even today, agricultural and forestry land is exempt from business rates. We abolished sporting hunting rates in the 1990s. And I was looking at, this is a bit of an aside, but there was a big building went on fire in Glasgow last November. It was big news because it was a big, big fire. There were 100 firefighters there, 20 appliances. It was right next to the M8 motorway. It closed the road for about a month, etc. It was an enormous fire. And when these things happen, going back to an earlier comment, I often ask, well, I always ask, who owns that building? So I went to the Registers of Scotland and got the title. And it's owned by a Belfast property development company. It was a former co-op building, in fact, owned by a Belfast property development company who'd bought it in 2003, had done nothing with it, so it was just sitting there as a derelict building. Went up in flames 2011. I discovered that they paid no business rates at all because it's an empty industrial building and therefore it's exempt from business rates. Now, business rates are a land tax. They're a tax on property. They're levied at 42 pence in the pound of rental value of the property. So since 2003, this company had paid no business rates. Now, had they been paying business rates, they'd have paid in total over those 5, 6, 7 years about £700,000 to the City of Glasgow. But, of course, when the fire came, they expected the fire brigade to come out and put out the fire in their building. Of course, the fire brigade is paid for by local taxes, to which this company has contributed absolutely zilch. Moreover, Strathclyde Fire and Rescue themselves, in 1 year, in fact, in 2011, paid £2.5 million in business rates across their fire stations, etc. So, I mean, this is a fundamental question about who's paying taxes and who gets the benefit from the protection that the state affords by way of defence and fire and rescue and police and all the rest of it. And, of course, it's also worth recalling that the financial crisis that we're currently in started, arguably, in the United States of America, where financial institutions lent money to poor people they knew could not afford to pay those loans back to buy property, to buy land, to buy houses, so-called subprime mortgages. The whole of Ireland has collapsed under a massive Ponzi scheme as a consequence of lending that at the height of the bubble exceeded 2.5 times the size of the Irish economy. So this failure to manage land properly in the economy as a whole has led to, you know, major crises. It's leading to a major crisis in Spain just now, and it's time we did something about it. And it's no secret that you know, banks and financial institutions have been very happy to lend on land and property, because as long as prices are rising, as long as there's a bubble, then there's great returns to be had. And we really need to break that cycle of boom and bust. In fact, Gordon Brown was in town, Edinburgh, just this week, talking about it. And he was a chancellor who in 1997 said that he didn't want any return to boom and bust, and he didn't want house prices to get out of control. They promptly trebled under his 10 years as chancellor. So yeah, I mean, to my mind, land is much more than, you know, kind of rural land. It's much more than the Highlands and Islands. It's much more than community ownership or crofters or whatever. Those are the issues that have kind of dominated the headlines in many ways, but actually it's at the heart of how we organise our economic affairs.
The economics is looking pretty bleak. There are also financial criminals in the cabinet. I mean, we're looking at Lord Green, for example, who's been in charge of HSBC as they were laundering billions of dollars for the Mexican drug cartels back in 2008. Now, do you see redistribution of land to ordinary people as some kind of solution to a broken financial world?
I'm not sure if it's a solution to a broken financial world. I mean, the solution to a broken financial world is to democratize money, to democratize finance. And it's interesting looking at countries like Germany, where 40% of their banks are local authority Sparkassen, another 30% or so are local cooperative and mutual banks. So that 70% of German banking is in the hands of local people. And they've suffered no crises. I mean, the big banks, the big global banks in Germany, of course, Deutsche Bank, etc., have actually driven some of the financial crisis. But if we returned to more locally owned, democratically controlled money supply, we wouldn't have the problems that we've had. And I mean, Germany is another interesting contrast, because my wife's aunt lives there, and I was visiting her a couple of years ago and asked her how they were coping with the financial crisis. And of course, she said, well, 56, 57, 58% of us live in rented accommodation. So we haven't poured vast sums of debt into a speculative housing bubble. That's money that's available for consumption or for saving or for investment in real things. And also, we make very little use of credit cards, so there's no great personal debt problems in Germany. So I think there are lessons for fixing the broken financial system. I think, I mean, the land question is about basically democratizing land and making sure that everybody has access to the basic fundamentals they need of food and shelter, because I believe it's a human right to be able to get hold of a piece of land. I mean, land should not be something that is used for speculative gain, that's used to enrich the elite, and that's what it has been. So I think the two are related, but I don't think necessarily that democratizing land is going to sort the financial problem unless we democratize money as well.
Well, one of the most interesting things he said there, Martin, was this whole idea of Gordon Brown saying he wanted to end a boom and bust in the economy, and yet it was booming and there was a bubble blowing up right the way through Gordon Brown's premiership. The idea of boom and bust, surely, I mean, you as an economist, can you tell us whether it's inevitable? Has there got to be boom and bust? I remember that's something I was told at school, whatever, 30 years ago or something, that this was inevitable.
Well, I mean, I think booms and busts are inevitable if you've got a capitalist style of organisation, and that's what we've had for the last 200 years or so. So that booms and busts are integral to that. Incidentally, what I was taught when I was learning economics in the 1970s is that there was booms and busts, or the business cycle did exist, but there would never be a crash like the 1930s, because governments knew now how to avoid such things by judicious intervention. But of course, most of the mechanisms by which governments did intervene to prevent booms and busts have been undermined. And I think the contrast he showed with Germany there, where basically everybody rents and the economy chugs along at a certain level, is very different from the way we run stuff in this country.
Over half people are renting in Germany. I'm not sure how that compares to here. You were saying 56%.
Yeah, but what that implies is that private owners of houses do not see massive capital gains. Basically, if you choose to buy, you choose to buy, but it's not going to be any cheaper or any better for you than renting. And of course, that means the German economy is more stable. It's a more stable, it's a Bausprung-Dirk technique, and we've got basically something that overheats and then crashes.
The other surprising statistic there was 70% of banking in Germany in the hands of local people.
It won't save them, because Deutsche Bank, as he said, has been involved in all of the shenanigans, and they are the commanding heights of the economy. I mean, democratising access to land, democratising money, all good. I totally agree with it. But the problem we've got is that the commanding heights of the economy are controlled by fictitious financial capital, and they are basically insolvent, and they're going to pull us all down with them, because basically it's too late to do anything about it.
And this point about who's paying the tax and who's getting the protection, fascinating insight into a company that's had an empty industrial building for nearly a decade, and yet that when there's a fire there, they expect the protection, yet they paid no tax whatsoever.
Well, I mean, the obvious thing to do, as has been pointed out, is that they should pay their business rate, whether they're using the building or not. They'd soon sell it to somebody who was going to use it. They certainly wouldn't sit there and leave it empty. And that, of course, is one of the big arguments in favour of land value taxation. The reason we haven't got land value taxation is because those who own the land don't want to pay those taxes. They'd rather the rest of us were made to pay. So we have, in fact, got a kind of financialised feudalism. Most people don't care too much about that, as long as they seem to be getting along fine. But once in a generation, it crosses everybody's minds that this is an intolerable situation, which it is.
So the subprime mortgages you also mentioned there, and the bubble, which we talked about just after the end of the clip, the bubble. What's the motivation for lending lots and lots of money to people that may not be able to pay it back? Is it simply to inflate prices. How does that all work into the economy and inflating house prices? Because that happened in the US and it happened here.
Well, it's a one-way ticket to wealth as long as the bubble's going up, isn't it? If you think of the Duke of Westminster, he's the biggest landowner in Britain. While house prices were rising by 300% under Gordon Brown's chancellorship, not his premiership, then the Duke of Westminster is worth squillions, is worth 300% more than he was at the beginning of that process. That is a massive amount of subsidy to one individual, isn't it? And what have they done to deserve that? Nothing. What have they contributed to society? Nothing. And economists like Ricardo pointed this out in the 19th century, that basically the landowning class don't contribute. If you're a manufacturer and you design a better widget, or if you're a worker and build a widget, you've contributed something. But if you're just providing the land, and it's basically your land, what are you contributing?
But it's also, you know, it doesn't just apply this, does it, to empty buildings. It's also Starbucks. I mean, Starbucks, it can become quite clear, mostly through work done by The Guardian and various associates of theirs over the last few weeks, that Starbucks are making billions of pounds in Britain and yet not paying a penny in taxation.
Well, that's to do with corporation tax not being properly collected. One of the problems we say is if you raise taxes on the rich, they'll all run away. What can we do? And I remember discussing this with economists in Moscow in the 90s, and the obvious solution is you tax land, because land can't run away. And therefore, you know, they have to have their mansions, they have to have these things, and therefore they can't run away. And if they do run away, you simply impound the building. And ultimately, it's the only serious way to get money out of the wealthy classes.
OK, let's have a listen now to the final clip of this interview with Andy Whiteman. Crofting is something which I think is quite unique, really, in the British Isles, as a way of enshrining in law a lot of the pre-enclosure types of land ownership and the ways of managing land. Can you give us a bit of an insight from Scotland as to what are the principles of crofting that differs from what we're used to, you know, sort of freeholds and leaseholds and these kinds of tenure?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because, I mean, this was... Crofting applies to a modest number of people, about 17,000 people who live in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. But it was introduced by Gladstone, William Gladstone, in 1886. And for that time, the introduction of crofting tenure was very radical and very revolutionary. Basically, what it did, these crofters had been cleared. They were now living down by the coast in the Highlands. They'd been cleared from the inland during the clearances. And they were quite happy down at the coast in after a certain fashion, but they didn't have security of tenure. So when there was a second round of threats of clearance, there was a lot of agitation in the 1870s around this, and there was a commission appointed to look into their problems. And it concluded that, in fact, these peasants, tenants, needed security of tenure. And that's what they got under crofting tenure. They got absolute security of tenure that was heritable, and therefore it could be bequeathed to their children, and therefore, in effect, indefinite. They have got access to a judicial process, the land court, to govern rents. It was an established principle that rent should only be paid on the unimproved value of the croft. That's to say that once the crofter built a house, improved the land, etc., the landlord had no right to take any share of that wealth, because that was wealth that had been created by the tenant. So it gave them security of tenure, but they were still tenants. They were still tenants, and still are today tenants. But what it did do was it enabled a population in a specific part of the country to remain, to have security. I mean, some of them did leave, but they still had security to go back. And so it preserved a population and, by consequence, a culture, a Gaelic culture, in places where, had crofting not been applied, it would have been lost. And it's interesting to note that in parts of the Highlands, like Aberdeenshire and Perthshire, where crofting tenure did not apply because the lowland landowners in the House of Lords did not want crofting tenure to extend to the lowlands, so they restricted it to those parts of the Highlands that the Napier Commission had visited. So you go to upland Highland Aberdeenshire today, around Balmoral, where the Queen is today, and you'll find vast abandonment of old settlements. In fact, in my book, The Poor Had No Lawyers, which is a quote taken from a 19th century advocate, constitutional lawyer, who lamented the fact that during the appropriation of the commons, the rich landowners got it all and the poor had none, because the poor had no lawyers. In these areas of upland Aberdeenshire, there are vast abandoned settlements. A abandoned because the landowners had the freedom to evict these people who did not have the protection of crofting tenure. And in fact, there's one lady I got to know very well, Jean Bain, when I lived in Aberdeenshire. She lived in a lovely little croft overlooking Balmoral, in fact. She died in 1992. Her son, Rob Bain, died 2 years ago. And their croft, Ardoch, is now owned by a London architect. The significance of this is that that croft, Jean and her son Rob, only ever had year-to-year security. They only, in fact, had what crofters had in the rest of the Highlands prior to 1886. And as a consequence, that is why Gaelic, for example, died in Deeside. I mean, we might romanticise Deeside and the Queen and Balmoral, but the indigenous culture of Deeside is dead. Jean Bain was the last native speaker of Deeside Gaelic. Deeside Gaelic is now dead. And it's dead precisely because it did not have the land tenure reforms that the rest of the Highlands did. So giving protection to people, allowing them to live on land, giving them security, allowing them to raise families is an integral part as well of nourishing the culture of a place. And today, you know, we have a situation in Scotland and in the UK where six-month short assured tenancies are what is legitimate to offer people. Now, you cannot build a sustainable community on the idea, on the threat, that every 6 months you might have to move. And going back to my German example, you know, I can move to Hamburg and I could get an unlimited duration tenancy in the centre of Hamburg in a very nice flat for about 8% of my income, as opposed to the 30 or 40% of people's take-home pay they're having to pay on mortgages or rent today in big cities in Britain. And that's unsustainable. So that's a little bit about the history of crofting. It was really a protection afforded to a very vulnerable group at the height of the struggles for land in the 19th century. It contrasted with the response in Ireland, of course. The response in Ireland was to give the peasants ownership. And that's something that I think, in hindsight, would have been better. It also didn't address the fact that they'd been cleared from their traditional lands, and these traditional lands are now lying as empty estates owned by an elite across the Highlands of Scotland. There's nothing's been done to address that.
I find it amazing that you cannot use, apparently, a croft as collateral against a loan. Can you explain how that works? Because this is how many people, including now right across England, elderly people, it looks, will lose their homes because those homes are being used as to sort of pay for their elderly care, this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, housing as a collateral is a product of our infatuation with home ownership and how we organise finance. I mean, as an aside, it's interesting that in the United States they have non-recourse loans, which basically means that if you lose your house, the lender can reclaim the collateral, but if the collateral has collapsed in value by 50%, that's all they get. Whereas in the UK, you know, if you take out a mortgage, the lender can pursue you for the whole value of that original mortgage, even though you're deep in negative equity, can pursue you for 12 years, I think it is in England, and 20 years under Scots law. So this whole system of debt and property is not actually liberating people at all. It's actually holding them in chains. Now, the reason that crofters who own their own home, but they do not own the land on which it's built, they are tenants, albeit secure tenants, the reason they cannot get a mortgage is because lenders do not like the fact that the collateral is not owned by the borrower. It's as simple as that. The croft and everything built on the croft technically belongs to the landowner, even though there's nothing the landowner can do to recover it. And therefore, a lender would find it very, very difficult to recover that same property if the borrower defaulted. So it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's meant that crofters have found it difficult to access credit to invest in building a house. On the other hand, it means they've never got mired in vast debt, which is a good thing too. And there's quite a lot of revival in the crofting communities. People are wanting to go back, and they're able to go back because they have a family who have a croft. And they can actually also now build a house, and they can actually build very, very good houses. There's a company, and I have nothing to do with this, so this is not a puff for them, but called Hebridean Homes. Look them up on the internet. They do lovely little houses, kit-build houses, but very, very high quality. I think they're designed to Danish building standards. Beautiful houses, very high quality. You can go on their website, you can look at the prices. You can buy a two-bedroomed, lovely house for $35,000. Now, that's affordable. Okay, you have to service the plot with electricity, water, call it another $5,000, and you have to fit out the house with plumbing and electric, so call that another $5,000. So let's say $45,000. You can buy a beautiful house, a really, really nice house. Now, families on median incomes of $25,000 can afford a debt of $45,000. The big problem is the land to put that house on. That's going to cost you $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $120,000. And that's where crofting comes into play, because you don't need to pay that kind of money for land on a family croft. You can happily build a house. So, yeah, we need to think seriously about land tenure, I think, because our current model of sort of absolute ownership, if you like, is flawed. It's vastly indebted. I mean, British households now are in debt to the tune of 100% of GDP. It's going to rise to about £2.5 trillion of household debt in the UK, much of which is tied up in completely unproductive assets, homes. Now, German families are not mired in that kind of debt, and therefore they've got far, far greater spending capacity, investment capacity, saving capacity. And it's a principal reason, I think, why Britain's not going to get out of its decline, because we've invested far too much debt in home ownership.
Andy Whiteman, again there, the author of The Poor Had No Lawyers, talking to me a few weeks ago from his home in Edinburgh. Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, one of the most striking statistics he came out there with there was in Germany, 8% of people's disposable income is going on their home, rent or mortgage, and in the UK it's 30%.
Yes, and also he drew out the implication at the end that Britain's decline is largely due to our land ownership structure, which I wouldn't disagree with. I mean, it's a bit late to do anything about it now. You understand if you spend several generations doing the wrong thing, even if you start doing the right thing, you're not going to catch up with the Germans who've been doing the right thing all along.
Why is land tenure so important, though? Because he kept using that word, didn't he? I mean, we're talking about leaseholds, freeholds, this kind of thing. But the interesting thing about the crofting system is that you have basically a permanent right to stay, and you're actually paying only the rent for a field, which is peanuts. It's actually a peppercorn rent.
Well, yes, but he also pointed out that what happened in Ireland during the same period was much more revolutionary, in the sense that people got the land and they owned it. And that's why you'll find that the rural parts of Ireland are a lot more lively than rural parts of Scotland today, 100 years later. That's not to say that they haven't got problems in Ireland. They have. I mean, as he mentioned in another one of the clips about all the money that was spent in the Irish property bubble. I think the thing to do is to design your country not to have property bubbles. And the Germans set off to do that a long time ago, and they've been very successful in it, and we haven't.
Also, those nice cabins he was talking about, £45,000 for one of those, which is, it starts to be more affordable than the sort of £150,000 that we generally have to pay for a home here in England.
Well, yes, but I mean, the point is that what you do with your land ownership structure has implications for how your economy will function. Britain's economy is geared around rent-seeking by elites. And that doesn't mean that they are producing a better widget. In actual fact, they're not interested in producing a better widget.
What do you mean by rent-seeking?
Rent-seeking is an economics term. Rent-seeking means where you get paid something for doing nothing. So rent, basically, if I'm a landowner and I rent land out to people, I don't do anything, but they give me money. That is rent-seeking. And there are other ways of rent-seeking as well. So, you know, if you're a corrupt customs official, you just get handouts from people to turn a blind eye when people are smuggling stuff. That's also rent-seeking. Getting a job with the government because you voted for a certain political party, that can also be classified as rent-seeking. So in economics terms, rent-seeking means where you get given something for doing nothing. And, of course, what you want to do if you're designing an efficient economy is nobody should be paid anything for doing nothing. You should reward people for what they contribute, and what they don't contribute they shouldn't be rewarded for.
Well, we hear quite a lot of Conservatives, don't we, talking about the something for nothing culture, and talking about things like people claiming disabled benefits and job seekers allowance and these kinds of state benefits. But what you seem to be saying is that there's actually quite a massive elite that's also getting something for nothing.
Well, exactly. People that they're not opposed to subsidies, they're just opposed to subsidies for poor people. So when you create your forest in Scotland and get a tax break, when the the banks get bailed out so that your savings get saved, when the whole of economic policy is run to make sure that that money comes into your pocket like the Duke of Westminster, that in actual fact is handouts. Of course it is. What else is it? But of course the society doesn't see it like that, and they don't see it like that. They just regard it as their entitlement.
Andy Whiteman was also talking about the cultural effect of this. I mean, it sounds like the way that people were evicted and kept on very short tenancies, which, I mean, he actually a year-long tenancy, and he was saying there in England, often in Britain, it's only a 6 months short tenancy at the moment. But he was saying that this had a devastating effect on the culture. It sounds like sort of almost like, social engineering.
Well, it's basically getting rid of people who are in the way, and you see it going on all over the third world today. In India, Brazil, I mean, this basically the powerful have always dominated the powerless. It's just by definition. And the ruling class in Britain has dominated Scotland, dominated Ireland, dominated India. We're still at war in the Middle East. We're still at war in Afghanistan. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, as the French say.
But to get work, people were evicted to make way for sheep,
yes.
Mostly.
Yes, but I mean, that was what was making money at the time. They're not making much money on sheep these days. It's what they're doing is either putting forests up or shooting deer. You know, you bring in a Russian oligarch and a Saudi prince to shoot some deer, and that's how you make your money.
And he also talked about the way that even if you walk away from your house here in Britain, you don't walk away from the debt, and described that as holding people in chains. Now, we seem to have got a bit of a raw deal there, because even with the Americans, if you walk away from your house, all that the mortgage company, the debt people with debts can get is the house, not the amount of money that you borrowed to buy that house.
Yes, well, I mean, the mortgage tax relief on buying your own house was brought in the 1920s in Britain in order to undermine the labour movement, in order to make it very difficult for people to go on strike, and also to give people a sense of having a stake in the country. And that's why they get mortgage tax relief. There's actual fact, there's no rational reason to give people mortgage tax relief. And if you didn't have mortgage tax relief, you wouldn't get one of that would militate against property bubbles.
Well, I can tell you why it might be a good idea. It's to encourage people to buy their own home.
Yes, but you don't necessarily want to encourage everybody to buy their own home, because only a small minority, in actual fact, as the Germans have worked out, can actually afford to buy their own home. Everybody else needs to rent. And in actual fact, they worked that out years ago and they just get on with it. What we've got in this country is nobody can see how unique the British setup is, because everybody's been born into it, their parents have been born into it, everybody thinks that's the way it's done. And of course, it's actually the root of an awful lot of our problems, as Andy Whiteman so rightly pointed out.
The other point, of course, is this business of now the government is saying, you know, I'm afraid if you're getting old and you need health care of some sort, you need looking after, then we may have to take your home off you. So
not in Scotland, because the Scottish Devolved Assembly have said differently. And of course, you've got a different political and social history in Scotland. And they're not necessarily, I mean, it may be that they're going to go their own way. I mean, we've been talking about independence for Scotland this week. I don't know whether it'll happen, but you can see why they have a different view of it than the Southern English.
Do you think we may be looking at the situation? Because obviously Britain is not really a big industrial nation anymore.
Still the eighth biggest economy in the world or something like that.
It's a big economy, but the industry is elsewhere. Is there any kind of better strategy for a sort of post-industrial Britain, which doesn't leave everybody as peasant farmers or whatever, but it enables people to at least have the space without having to pay rent to somebody else in order to get on and do whatever they're good at, whatever their skills are?
I think we've got to think about Britain in 30 years' time as a post-industrial, human-centred economy. We will not be the richest country in the world, but we won't be the poorest. And if we use our resources wisely, we can live well. But first of all, we've got to break the back of the oligarchy that's had its foot on our neck for the last 300 years.
And how are we going to do that?
Through the democratic process. As the Chartists used to say, peacefully if we may, forcefully if we must.
Dance, baby, dance.
Stylistics there. And Sing Baby Sing. Now, from the 1970s, of course. Now I'm joined by Jason Yiannakopoulos. Hi, Jason. Welcome
Hello,
to
Hello, Bristol.
Hello, Jason. Right. You're a Bristol University of the West of England student. What were you studying at UWE?
I did a bachelor's degree in linguistics in German, which was 4 years in undergrad, and it meant I did actually have to spend a year out in Germany, which is intriguing.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, we've just been talking about the German model. I mean, did you get a sense over there that people were just a little bit more content? And, you know, one of the things that bothers me about, I visited Scotland recently when I came back to England, it was that people sort of walk around very fast here. They seem to be a sort of, they drive around a lot faster and they seem to be in a hurry most of the time because there seems to be pressure on people to sort of earn more money for some reason. Did you find it was a little bit more relaxed in Germany or just the same as here?
No, really, because in Germany they're very precise, they're very direct. So you know, like the 8:30 bus will arrive at 8:30 and leave at 8:31 whether on it or not. Yeah. You know, so they do have that thing. Germany has a very interesting. It's almost got like a DIY culture. It's kind of like if you are with a disability, then you have to contact people and make your own arrangements in a way. I mean, I found this out when I was abroad, I did the linguistics at the University of Hanover in Hanover, and in one of the classes there's a blind girl, and the university didn't actually arrange her care for her. She had had somebody just sitting there taking her notes for her, essentially, and she was just listening in.
I noticed, because you're a disabled person yourself, do you want to just tell us a bit about your disability?
Well, I have Asperger's syndrome, which is I have two actually. I've got dyspraxia and Asperger's syndrome. Asperger's syndrome itself is one of an umbrella of disabilities under the autistic spectrum disorder. So it's a form of autism where we're sort of slightly more engaged, and also rather, although we have the obsessive side, it's not a compulsive thing. So it's really hard to explain. So maybe slightly more engaged. That's how we come across. And dyspraxia is it's often referred to the clumsiness disability, and again, it's related, but not actually part of the autistic spectrum.
Now we've seen recently quite a lot of the disabled people are getting active. They're campaigning. They're in the news because they're having a lot of their benefits taken away. A lot of disabled people are complaining that this company Atos is basically saying they're all prepared and ready for work, even if maybe they're not. You know, what's your experience?
It is ridiculous. I mean, a lot of stuff that Atos comes up with is the. There was a case with one person where they had a life-threatening illness, and Atos told them that they were able to work, and then they promptly died a few months later. So it's.
Are disabled people, do you think, quite politically politicised and aware and active?
Probably more now, yes, because they've come up with the thing. But they're taking away the benefits and trying to force more people into work because of we have the problems with the economy and all that. But it hasn't been amazingly well thought through. I mean, anyone who has to go through that ATOS test has to go for a test every 6 months. Now, imagine if you've got a lifelong disability, if you have to be in a wheelchair, and it says, you know, hello, hello, are you in your wheelchair? Yes. And then 6 months later you go back, I see you're still in your wheelchair. Well, yes, that's not going to change. Oh, well, we'll come back in 6 months. You know, it's a ridiculous idea.
Okay, Jason. Well, thanks ever so much for joining us. And hopefully we'll hear more from you on BCFM. With a bit of luck. Let's keep our fingers crossed because we're trying to get you on the air here a little bit more. All right. Thanks ever so much. Now, Jeff Sparks.
Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 26th of October, Roxy Music tribute act Roxy Magic will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £9 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Into Saturday, 27th of October, Alien Stash Tin will be performing with support from Port Talbot-based rockers Texas Flood at the Casbar in Market Street, Llanelli. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is free. This gig will also be a Halloween fancy dress bash, so get your horror rags on. Into Song of the Week, and I present Muddy Waters. He is generally considered as the father of modern Chicago blues and a major inspiration for many musicians and bands. In his career, which spanned 40 years, he released roughly 30 albums and 60 singles. This is a song which he recorded in 1950 and is titled Rolling Stone.
Well, I wish I was a catfish, swimming in a whole deep blue sea. I would have all you good looking women fishing after me, showing up after me, showing up after me. Hold on, hold on, showing up. I went to my baby's house and I sat down on her step. She said, come on in now, buddy, you know my husband just now left. Showing up and just now left. Showing up and just now left. Hold on. Oh well, oh well. Well, my mother told my father just before I was born, I got a boy child coming, gonna be a rolling stone. Sure enough, he's a rolling stone. Sure enough, he's a rolling stone. Oh well, he's a. Oh well, he's a. Oh well, he's a.
Muddy Waters with Rolling Stone. For more information on him, you can check out at www.muddywaters.com. Keeping with Saturday, 27th of October, Terror will be performing with support from Brutality Will Prevail, Broken Teeth, and also Failure to Follow at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Into Sunday, 28th of October, Gaz Coombs of Supergrass fame will be performing with support from Cave Painting at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £12.50 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, between now and next week, Jeff, are you going to be out on Halloween? Dressed in your spider gear?
No, I'll definitely hide away. Definitely not going to get involved.
Yeah, it's become a bit Americanised. You know what? I was walking down the aisle in Morrison's the other day and the entire side of one of the aisles is all stuff for Halloween. So it's become a bit commercialised, don't you think?
It has become very commercialised.
Okay, so don't look out for Jeff on Halloween. He won't be banging on your door.
Yeah, don't look out for Tony either. He'll be hiding away as well.
I won't be. No. I don't hide away. No. I shall be out there just making sure, keeping all these Halloweeners in line.
Yes, with your own brand of justice.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. See you next week.
See you next week.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player. Produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. And available online. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. And you can sign up for that or download the weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect's a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, generally aimed at school children and parents. 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week.
Just upon a smile.